From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to the big event. Welcome to the intro, Aydin Vaziri.
I'm happy to be here. We're going to talk about one of my favorite people today, Joel Selvin. He's kind of my mentor. He's the guy who brought me in here, and he's a great storyteller more than anything else.
Yeah, this is the Joel Selvin episode. Technically, we're inducting Surrealistic Pillow by Jefferson Airplane into the SF Music Greatest of All Time. We did this with a Metallica album. We are going to talk Airplane and Marty Balin and Surrealistic Pillow, but we also want to talk Joel Selvin.
Absolutely, because he has so many. I mean, I think we talk a little bit about Hard Rock Cafe and a lot of other things. This is really like a San Francisco history lesson. It's so much more than Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, Joel, the music critic for the Chronicle for years, writing books now.
I call Joel at least once a week for advice, because anything that comes up in my line of work, he's done, he's encountered. I've had rock stars walk out on me, hang up the phone on me, call me very nasty names, and the first person I call whenever that happens is Joel, and he immediately makes me feel better and kind of minimizes the damage, and I can go in and fix whatever happened.
Mine is Jim Belushi. I remember Jim Belushi was really mad at me. I wrote like the five worst Super Bowl acts of all time, and he did some Blues Brothers thing during a Super Bowl halftime show. And he happened to be in town when this issue came out. This is more than 10 years ago. So Jim Belushi's trying to get a hold of me, and he's like calling all my numbers. He's sending me emails. We got to talk, you know, I want to talk to you about this. Finally, somehow he knew Joel. I don't know. I mean, everybody knows Joel.
Yes.
So Joel calls me and goes, "Hey man, you got to talk to Jim Belushi." And I said, "Yeah, but I, you know, said some stuff. I meant it, but I said something about his brother that," and Joel goes, "Well, would you say it to his face?" And I said, "Well, no, I wouldn't say that part to his face." He goes, "Well, Peter, that's the first rule. You can say what you want. I don't think anything you said was wrong, but don't say it if you're not going to say it to their face."
That's great advice, and that's exactly the kind of advice, yeah, I go to him for.
Yeah, yeah, and I got my symphonic ass-chewing from Jim Belushi. I mean, it went in movements. I mean, it was long, and but I took it, and I learned the lesson, and that was a great lesson. And Joel's like a great lesson guy. So very excited to have him on the podcast. I got to warn listeners, a little bit of profanity, maybe a lot of profanity. Normally, this is a podcast you can listen while you're taking your kids to soccer practice or something. This is not one of them.
Unless your kids are really cool.
Unless your kids are super cool. So thank you, Aydin, for coming along. And we're your concierge for culture in the Bay Area. I'm Peter Hartlob, and this is The Big Event. Welcome to The Big Event, Aydin and Joel. Joel, I am so happy to have you here. I feel like you're here when I'm down here already, though.
Oh, well, you know, we were talking about the basement. It's got a lot of ghosts down here.
Yeah, archive. So this was the archive during your heyday as well, correct?
I have no idea. I've never actually been in this room. I recognize the file folders from upstairs, yeah, the photos. I spent a lot of time in those looking at buildings for a book I did about San Francisco and musical history tour, and you know, I wanted pictures of things like the Civic Auditorium, and the photo library is fantastic for that. You know, I have Joe Rosenthal shooting pictures of the exterior of the Civic Auditorium in the 50s.
It's crazy that we work with that guy. So
I know.
The Big Event listeners know about the archive, and we talk about it, but there are actually two. There's the Microfiche and Negative Archive, which is not where we're at. And then this is a newer, it's been moved. These are all the photos around us and a bunch of newspapers, which are fantastic for audio.
It's a very big newspaper archive, because they didn't used to keep this many. If you wanted to go back beyond the month of the operation, you had to go down to the newspaper agency on the corner.
Yeah.
So they've obviously expanded the archive.
Well, we're going to talk about the Chronicle. I want to talk about a couple of your latest books. I want to talk about Hard Rock Cafe. But we're here to induct. We have this little thing, Joel, where we induct things into a Hall of Fame that doesn't really exist. And that's what we're going to do today. We do it with movies. We did, you know, Zodiac and The Birds. Mrs. Doubtfire, and we're doing it today with Surrealistic Pillow. Thought about it, I wanted an excuse to get you here, and I wanted to talk about Marty Balin a little bit too, because he passed recently.
Right.
Dean, you wrote the obituary.
Yes, and of course I referenced a lot of Joel's stuff, and as I was researching that, you know, when someone dies, you're on deadline and you want to get it up right away, but I kept getting distracted by all the articles he wrote about the lawsuits and the name changes and Paul Kantner acting crazy. And that obit could have been up like a good 2 hours earlier if I wasn't like caught up reading Joel's articles about them.
Well, there's Airplane was a big story. And the Surrealistic Pillow is the right album.
Yeah.
It was just a huge record in its day. It was released in February of 1967. It was the first record that the Airplane featured Grace Slick. She joined in October of 66 after they jettisoned their original female lead vocal, Signe Anderson. Her husband was the lighting director, and he was an unpleasant fellow, and I think he pretty much got her fired. But she said, oh, I'm going to have a baby, and I'm going to leave. But
yeah.
Grace was the obvious star of the scene. She was in a band called Great Society that was on bills with the Airplane. They all knew her.
Yeah.
So she comes into this thing in October. They make this album, and it's all Garcia's all over it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's like in the band, essentially.
You
for
say
this
all
record.
Over it.
He's playing guitar on all those tracks. Listen to Today by Marty Balin, and it's just like sounds like a Grateful Dead song. It has this Jerry Garcia lick that just brings right out. And when it came out in February of 1967, the whole country had just gotten news of the Human Being attracting 100,000 people in Golden Gate Park, and this whole hippie thing was starting to, you know, capture people's imagination. And here came this album. Just at the right time, at the right moment, White Rabbit, just nothing had ever sounded like that on the radio before.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't.
And it just took off and blew up by June, when White Rabbit had come down the charts and the Summer of Love was starting. The weekend that the Jefferson Airplane played Saturday night at the Monterey Pop Festival, their second single off the album, Somebody to Love, was either like number two or number three in the nation. So this album really was the definitional work of this new rock movement that would just burst upon everything throughout that year and from then on.
And there were bands that had been around, but this was bigger than anything at the time. You're talking about charts and things. I looked through old Chronicles, and that was what the coverage was. And this is before the Chronicle. I think we all wrote about how the Chronicle was really tough on the Summer of Love and kind of treated it as a crime story. But this is February, well, February, March. The Chronicle was pretty high on Surrealistic
Pillow.
So
the Chronicle and the Airplane have a very braided history.
Yeah.
When Marty Balin put that band together, he was living out on Clement Street, and one of his roommates was a copy boy at the Chronicle named Bill Thompson, and another one of the people involved in sort of the business management of whatever that they were doing was also a copy boy named Gary Blackman. So there were these people on the inside of the paper, and when they got the Matrix, which was this nightclub over on Fillmore that they turned a pizza parlor into, to play the first gig of Jefferson Airplane, John L. Wasserman was there to write an article about it. Mm-hmm. And there's a Pink Section article on the very debut of this band. Then furthermore, sometime shortly thereafter, Thompson and Blackman had mau-mau'd Gleason, Ralph Gleason, the distinguished and eminent jazz critic, into going and seeing the Airplane, and he flipped for them. There's a column. You can read it. And that...
I got it right here,
that
actually.
That one landed the... that's the Wasserman. The
yeah.
Gleason one landed the Airplane a record deal with RCA Victor.
Yeah.
And then it was off to the races.
And that quick.
Well, the first album was not much of a success outside of the Bay Area. It's No Secret was something around here a little bit, but it was the beachhead that established this new thing that was going on in San Francisco. The Quicksilver, Messenger Service, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Grateful Dead. Those guys were well behind the Airplane. The Grateful Dead's album doesn't come out until March of '67, and Airplane have two albums out by then. Quicksilver didn't put an album out until 68. So it's really, they were the avant-garde of the San Francisco rock scene. They were the
a real leap from the first album to Surrealistic Pillow, though, musically.
Garcia and Grace Slick.
Yeah.
And the, and Grace brought those, both those songs, White Rabbit and Somebody to Love. Now, if you want to drill down on the record, there's just some absolutely wonderful Marty Balin love songs. And there's the extraordinary Jorma Kaukonen, Embryonic Journey. So it's not exactly like it is all Grace's album. In fact, those are her two songs.
I've listened to it three times in the last 24 hours just to prepare for this podcast. Ideen, how many times did you listen to it?
It's been a while.
It's just in your DNA. Though,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. Right.
I feel like you can almost hear three different factions going on. You have the Marty Balin ballads, the Balin or Balin?
Balin.
Marty Balin ballads, and some of those I like a lot, but there are a lot of them. And then Somebody to Love and White Rabbit are just propulsive songs that don't quite fit that. And then you've got Embryonic Journey, which feels like Jorma going on his own direction, which I love. I want to hear a whole album of that, which we eventually could hear many albums of that. But it feels splintered, even
well,
on
that was the
second album.
That was the Airplane, and you didn't mention Kantner.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you can't really feel Kantner in there, but you know he's disturbing everybody and making everybody upset. Yeah. They were six people that never got along.
Yeah.
And that was the strength of them. They were like the Oakland A's of the 70s. Like they'd fight in the dugout and then go out on the stage and just kill. Saw many, many epic Airplane shows at the Fillmore and Winterland up till about 69. After that, 69... Well, the last really significant Airplane show was the night Janis Joplin died. Mm-hmm. And it was a really weird concert. It was Airplane, Dead, Quicksilver, and Hot Tuna at Winterland. It wasn't Bill Graham. It was some other guy. And then, get this, they were not only broadcasting it live on two different radio stations in this newfangled thing called Quadraphonic. And they were also broadcasting it on KQED television. So it was a very strange night, and Janis died in Los Angeles, and the news came backstage during the telecast, and Marty didn't come back the next night. That was his last night with the Airplane.
Mm-hmm.
He just had it. He was sick of it, and it wasn't the drugs he liked, and wasn't the scene he wanted to be in. And Marty always listened to his inner voice. I mean, he was, for his life, was that kind of person. I mean, he was just gone. He didn't even come back. And that also turned out to be the final performance with Quicksilver Messenger Service by their hallmark lead guitarist, John Cipollina.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a night where this whole San Francisco scene really turned a big wheel, right? And then somewhere like, I think that's October 1970. And that was the end of the Airplane, really.
Yeah. I mean, they came back in many incarnations.
I feel like I got the bum end of the deal with the Jefferson Airplane or Starship because the circumstances which I saw them live was, you know, at the tail end of their career. One time I was... You know, I had family in town. I was in Fisherman's Wharf, and there was Jefferson. I guess it was Jefferson Starship at the time, but they were playing, like, in the square by Ghirardelli, like, this free concert, and there were about 12 people there. And it was, like, it was the saddest thing. And then I saw them at the Summer of Love, like, the 40th anniversary thing in the park.
As I remember... They were okay that day because they were one of the few bands that had actually rehearsed.
Right.
But Ideen, listen, the thing you saw, the Kantner band, was nothing like what was in the heyday.
Of course. Well, yeah.
I mean,
that's
just
I'm saying.
Nothing
yeah.
like. I mean, Kantner was not the band leader, really. He was embedded in the band, but once he became the band leader of this Starship, it was a whole different tenor to things.
I mean, he's the one who kept it together and kept it rolling
all the way.
2015, whatever that was.
Amazing guy, Kantner. Really the only guy on the airplane who stayed in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
He used to go to shows every night. You'd see him out in clubs, you know, checking out the other bands. He was wise and droll and cynical, and you could always count on him for a quote if you wanted something in the newspaper. And he was a very contentious guy. I guess you discovered that. We Paul and I didn't speak for like a year or so because I called him an asshole. And he acted like he'd never heard that before. Like the word came as a surprise to him. And I guess, you know, rock stars don't get called that often. But Jonathan Richman says, nobody ever called Pablo Picasso asshole.
So you in 1999, you assigned me to review Jefferson's, was it Starship at the time? They had a comeback album, and they actually got Grace to sing on it, and they had a lot of the core key members on it, and it just sounded like a wall of screaming and guitar. Like everyone wanted to be turned up at maximum volume. And
was Grace in on this?
I think she was on a song. I could be wrong. I mean, it was
not
a while
on
ago.
On stage.
Not on stage.
Okay. Yeah.
This is an album review.
So
I wrote this thing, and you know, I basically said, you know, it just sounds like chaos. It's, you know, it's too noisy. The songs aren't there. And less than a week later, I got a 4-page handwritten letter from Paul basically calling me an asshole.
4 pages?
4 pages.
How long was your review?
There was a poem in it. There was like, the review was 150 words.
Isn't it nice to know he cared? You know?
And
really?
I talked to him, you know, I met him later, and he was a nice guy, but he really did care. He read that review and was not happy about it.
Well, Paul took himself pretty seriously, but not you. That's pretty much how he played it. The airplane was so great. They just, like I said, they were just super contentious and never got along. Now, they got inducted into the Hall of Fame, and I was pumped about that. And I remember calling their old publicist, Cynthia Bowman, and saying, oh man, I want to be all over this. I'm going to go to New York and I want to see the first rehearsal. I want to see the first dinner together. I want to catch the first fight. And she says, oh, you already missed that. So we get there in New York, and I mean, they're the first sort of hippie band that's being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and it's a complete range of attitudes about this. Like, Yorma goes out and buys the first suit he's ever owned to wear that night. And Jack Casty shows up in a tuxedo. Kantner, street clothes, right? And Grace doesn't come. And she says she's got some affliction called hot feet, and she can't wear shoes, you know, and so she's not flying across the country with hot feet. So you can imagine that the producers of the television show that the event is going to create are a little disappointed that Grace Slick isn't there. So this guy, I can almost remember his name, he's still producing this damn show. He's like going around to Kantner and the band to try and convince them that Joan Osborne, who's on hand, should sit in for Grace, and he goes to Kantner first, and Kantner says, gives him a really haughty, chilly look, and you know, hears him out, and then he says, well, speaking for myself, I say 60% no, and 40% no. So the guy's like, oh, God, and then he goes and he finds Marty. Now, Marty is like this super empathetic guy, And he engages with him. He's looking right in this guy's eyes really seriously and really feels his pain and listens to him. And soberly, after the guy finishes his pitch, he says, I don't know, man. I mean, she's kind of hot right now. Maybe we should do her songs. He went away scratching himself, that guy.
Can we talk about the name changes? And it got confusing because
there were lawsuits involved too at some point.
And I remember reading an article of yours where this board, which Paul was a member of, ended up suing Paul. Is that right?
It's foggy, but I'm thinking there were these strange lawsuits over who controlled the name, and Paul controlled it. They all found that out and were very unhappy because they'd gone on without him at some point. And they'd become despicable. They were the We Built This City version of the band. And Kantner told them they couldn't be Jefferson Starship anymore. And they went, what? We certainly can be. Nope, they couldn't. So they became Starship.
Right.
And Jefferson Starship was Paul and Grace doing a crazy solo album in like 1970 with David Crosby, while the Airplane still kind of existed, and then the Airplane didn't really exist anymore. And he kept that Jefferson Starship thing going. And then Marty shows back up in, what, 75, 76, with the guests on one album, and then it joins the band with the express intention of writing hit records, and he writes Miracles.
Yeah, right. It's a great song.
It's a hit record. Yeah. And that's and Marty said he was there for three albums and three hits, and then he was gone. And that's right. He was. He just disappeared. He couldn't take those guys in to lunch, and he was an autistic child, didn't speak till he was 6 years old, and he was just this marvelous self-contained unit. I really loved Marty Balin a lot. He was so interesting and creative and true to himself, and he gave me one of my great life lessons, Peter.
What's that?
Well, we were doing this interview, and he told me that he'd matured. I guess, you know, he was in his late 30s, and I was in my early 30s, maybe, and I said, really? What'd you learn that matured you? He says, well, assholes don't count. And I was like, rang a bell for me, and I've never been the same person since.
Well, let's rewind a little bit and talk about him and his significance. Idine, you just wrote an obituary on him. What did you learn about him?
Well, it's the interesting thing was that it sounded like he started the band exclusively to have a band to play The Matrix, the club he opened. Like, that was his main motivation, was to just
other way
have
around.
A house.
Open the club band. The band would have a place to play.
Right. And then it sounds like he just wanted to write love ballads. Like, that was that was all he wanted to do, was, like, write these ballads like Miracles, which he finally got. But everything else that happened around him was just kind of like...
Well, now, wait a second. What about Plastic Fantastic Lover, 3/5 of a Mile in 10 Seconds? So, you know, I mean, those are not love songs.
Right.
Those are hardcore rockers.
Right.
You know, what you're saying, I think more accurate would be say that his best work is often those love ballads. And you remember, it was the summer of love. The love was an important topic to these bands.
I think that he gets... he got a bad break, and that the types of songs that he wrote, and these songs are on Surrealistic Pillow, are the songs that later, like Christopher Guest, would make fun of on Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind, and they'd start putting in commercials as kind of almost an ironic representation of songs from the 60s.
Today, I feel like pleasing you more than before. Today, I know what I wanna do, but I don't.
So when I listen to Surrealistic Pillow, I'm like, the Marty Balin songs are they're good songs, but I also, this little thing clicks in my brain that I'm supposed to sort of be feeling this false nostalgia, or maybe even laughing at it a little bit. And those were his songs, and I kind of think he almost got a bad break.
Well, I would refer you to Blessed's Pointed Little Head. Mm-hmm. Which is the 5th album, and it's a live recording done at the Fillmore East. It's a stomping rock band, and Marty's right at the front, and it's Chuglin, man. I mean, he liked love ballads. He was good at it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not with you on that. I think that Surrealistic Pillow is of a piece, of its time. It's a gorgeous little unified thing, and the reason it's unified is because Garcia. Garcia ties all the tracks together. You can go back and listen to it again, look for Garcia's work, and you'll start hearing it pop out of the background. And go, oh, there he is. Oh, there he is.
Yeah.
I think for Peter and I coming to the band later on, they never held the weight of, like, the Doors or the Beatles or the Beach Boys, you know,
even
other
the Dead.
Groups from that. Like they just
no, it's they were gone and splintered, and their influence was just dissipated before you know, Jim Morrison was cold in his grave,
right?
But at the time, they were the tops. There were tops at Woodstock. There were tops at Monterey Pop. You talk about the Doors. You know, the Doors and the Airplane toured Europe together. And everybody remembers the concert in Amsterdam where they were going to switch back and forth. The Airplane was going to open one and close the next. And they were going to open this show. And Marty, I mean, I remember him telling me about this, just still amazed all these years later. Jim Morrison came to Amsterdam, ate a bunch of hash, a really large amount of hash, and then did a lot of drinking, and then showed up at the gig, and he sees the Airplane, and he's like, "Oh man, this is great!" And he comes running out onto the stage in the middle of their show, dancing like a da 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 da, and he starts like doing a little pirouette thing around Marty, and Marty's like there, and Marty's like realizing, "Man, this guy is tangling himself up in my microphone cord. Man, this is not what the hell?" And next thing you know, sure enough, mic cord cinches up around his ankles and down Morrison goes, out, cold, leaves the auditorium in an ambulance. Oh. And the other guys in the band are standing in the wings going, "Oh, what are we going to do after the Airplane set?"
Oh, can we talk about Marty at Altamont?
Marty at Altamont. So Altamont was just, it was such a huge deal in that band. It screwed up so much, and they hadn't really been involved in the planning because they were on tour and it was all happening real quick, and they were rich and successful. The Dead were poor and hanging around town, so the Dead got the chores of putting it together. Certainly the Airplane knew all the San Francisco Hell's Angel guys. They were common figures around Haight, and everybody knew all those guys. So, like Sweet William, the guy that Kantner mixes it up with in the movie, they all knew him. He was Lenore Kandel's husband. He was everybody. So, Marty, this is the guy he was. He sees these angels beating up some guy in the front row, and he starts yelling at him to stop. And that's when this guy, Paul Hibbert, who was known as Animal, and he was wearing a coyote head on his for a hat that day. It looked really medieval. He flattened Marty. And Marty got up, and then he goes over to see if he can get over the lip of the stage to break up. And he jumps down, and they hand it to him again. And I talked to the manager, the road manager, Bill Laudner. I said, "Where were you?" He says, "Oh man, I ran forward when I saw him go over, and I looked down and I says, I can't be any help down there." He says, so he lay down on the stage, and somebody handed Marty's arm up to him, and he pulls Marty up. Marty is out cold. He takes him back and throws him in a truck. There's nowhere else to do. There's some girl named Rosie McGee, Phil Lesh's girlfriend, is back there like trying to recover from an accidental acid trip, and they throw Marty's lifeless body on her. But Animal, who's pretty high himself, comes back to the truck, and he's sobbing and he's crying. "Oh, Marty, I didn't mean to, And Marty gets up and looks at Paul and says, "Fuck you." And Hibbert says, "Never say that to a Hell's Angel," and beats up Marty a second time. Now, it was one of the little tiny research projects in my book about Altamont was, did Marty come back and finish the set? Right? So nobody remembered. Marty didn't remember. Paul didn't remember. Jack didn't remember. Yorma didn't remember. Grace didn't remember. Nobody. No. So finally, I found some underground newspaper, the San Francisco Good Times or something, that said that Marty came back and sang the last song, Volunteers, with the band. It was like, okay. So he went back. But then Spencer Dryden, the band's drummer, had been overdosed on LSD. And these guys had flown overnight from Florida to get to this. They'd had like 2 hours sleep, and they're all just nuts. And Spencer just wandered off and got lost in the crowd. And they left without him. They, you know, he had to find some guy in the audience to drive him home. And he was out of the band within a month or two. Marty, everybody says, was never the same again. I mean, it was a heavy day for the airplane. Big deal.
Wow.
And all in your book, Altamont, right in front of me.
Every bit, yeah.
You brought me a copy.
Of course, Peter. Perks for the press, Mitchell said, handing me a stack of videotapes.
You wrote, like, the Summer of Love book 20 years before you wrote Altamont. How much of the story was clarified in that time? Like, how much more did you learn in that 20 years?
Well, I hadn't really drilled down so much on the Altamont when I did the Summer of Love, but I did. It is a chapter of that book, and I like collected a lot of accounts, and then went back 20 years later to some of the same sources, like Marty. And actually, his 1993 interview was much more clear and much more detailed. So a lot of, and Spencer wasn't around by that time. He was already dead. And his interview was very important. So a lot of that material was really good from Summer of Love. Then as I started to do a book, I concentrated on interviews with more like stagehands and, you know, people that were doing the concert. Because I hadn't talked to them for Summer of Love, and they had fantastic stories. I mean, just don't forget putting up an entire public address system in the dark. You know?
That's awesome. You mentioned empathetic. I wanted to close the Jefferson Airplane loop with Marty. Empathetic. What was he like? I mean, to interview him. You interviewed him pretty recently.
Oh, yeah. I always stayed in touch with Marty.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really admired the hell out of him, and he never stopped writing new songs and making demos and thinking he was just one song away from being back on. Just last year, he did a bunch of old Airplane stuff and redid it, and it's up there on YouTube. It's fantastic. He did a song 2 years ago called Summer of Love that's just heart-touching. But, you know, there's no hope for the 60s rockers in today's music industry. Yeah. But Marty didn't know that, and he didn't know to stop. He was just this incessantly creative guy. He had a smart aleck kind of attitude about things, but he wasn't mean. He wasn't cynical. And I think I told you or Sam that he was really a James Dean kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And he was. He was that cool, and he was that self-contained, like I said. No, Marty was something special. So was Kantner, too. And Yorma and Jack are amazing, and Grace. I mean, this was a collection of unique, powerful personalities that didn't exactly gel but did have a synergy.
So Surrealistic Pillow, we're agreeing it's a classic. Give me a couple other, like, give me one Marty and one with each of the kind of factions of the band, something that we should check out that you really like.
Well, like I said, Bless Its Pointed Little Head is still on my playlist. I'll pull that out and throw it on. It starts with the end of the King Kong movie, because they always showed the last scene of King Kong in between acts. Mm. And it starts with, you know, was it Beauty that saved the Beast? And then Spencer's little drum beat, you know, like, it's a very cool record. The Airplane's recorded canon is not that great. There's some good bootlegs out officially now, like Grace's First Date at the Matrix is on a CD, and there's some real good Fillmore East and Fillmore West stuff from 68 that are out on CDs. I like the live Airplane stuff the best. It's the most cohesive, because, as you know, I mean, they just really didn't fit together quite right, you know? Yeah. And you look at things like After Bathing at Baxter's, and I mean, that's just a delirious mess. And they pull it back together a little bit for Crown of Creation, but again, it's like four different bands or three different bands on the same record. Mm-hmm. Volunteer is probably their best record after Surrealistic Pillow, but even that's got like Eskimo Blue Day on it, which is like pretty unlistenable in any kind of realistic fashion.
I wanted to just jump in, because I love it when I write something about one of your articles and then I get an email from you and then there's like a story that's four times better than what I just wrote. So Hard Rock Cafe.
I remember that night really well, because I showed up with a friend of mine who's a venture capitalist.
Well, let's back up. I wrote about the opening,
yeah,
which was in the 80s, and we did this tourist trap day thing where I took some people out and it was a lark to go see what the food's actually like at the Hard Rock Cafe now. This turns into an article, and then it ends up you covered the opening.
Yeah, but it was an amazing night. It was up on Van Ness in some old car dealership.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's like the third or fourth Hard Rock in the country, and it was a big deal. Hard Rock was a big deal. When they opened in New York, which was the second one after London, they had three-hour lines in Midtown Manhattan, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so it was a big deal. And they had some charity opening event, and I showed up there with a friend of mine who was a venture capitalist and already richer than God, and he'd bought the $75 tickets, which was wow, and there was no room. they shuffled him up to the garage up around the corner where they had like a video screen and another bar set up. He was not pleased.
Yeah, it was the VIP area, but it was like this garage, parking garage.
Yeah, it was the parking garage above the Hard Rock. They turned it into an annex because they'd oversold the thing so badly. And so I said, let's just go out to dinner. So we went out to some steakhouse across the street and then came back. And I don't remember what Frank did. I think, you know, he was like pissed off and left. But I'm outside, and Boz Scaggs has just managed to like slide in the door. And I'm standing there with Deborah Yall, the lead singer of Romeo Void, and the security guard is being just a smart ass with both of us and kind of offensive to Deborah. And then, you know, I flag somebody down, and the next thing you know, it's, oh, excuse me, you know, come on in. And about 10 minutes later, Cyndi Lauper's doing Girls Just Want to Have Fun, and Deborah's up on stage with her. I go back and found the security guard and said, see that? Okay.
So Cyndi Lauper's like the main act that's going to open.
Girls Just Want to Have Fun was like the biggest record of the day. She was so hot, and that was her first San Francisco appearance, and everybody wanted to see Cyndi Lauper. That was a very cool record.
Yeah, it's out on Fisherman's Wharf. Now, I don't know anybody who wants to go there. We have the photos, like Robin Williams was there, George Lucas.
So what year was that?
I'm thinking 83, 84.
Yeah, it was like 84.
So 10 years later, I saw Tribe Called Quest had put out an album, and like their record company made them do a promo show there, and they were, so I went there to interview them, and they were so miserable that they were actually wearing headphones listening to their own music to block out the PA, and they had their hoodies on and they were covering their faces, and I couldn't get anything out of them because they were just so hating being there so much.
I did an interview there with Mike Love of the Beach Boys, and the guy that came with Mike was sitting next to him, kept getting girls coming up and asking for his autograph. And I didn't know who the guy was. And I said, excuse me, but just who the fuck are you? And he gets offended and says, I'm Blackie from General Hospital. And that's how I met John Stamos. But I thought, you know, like, wait a second, aren't you? No, you got a real name. You're not a TV character, are you? I'm Blackie from General Hospital. The Hard Rock was a scene for that kind of stuff. I remember radio shows being there. I mean, it was cool for a moment. It was.
Right. Everyone had the T-shirt.
The waitresses. Oh, now the T-shirts. Here's the story on that. In London, if you came, the only way you could get a T-shirt was one of the two owners, Peter or Isaac, gave it to you. That was it. They were in the back office, and if Paul and Linda and the kids came in, out came some T-shirts here. So they were really authentically hard to come by. They were treasures, right? And then they opened the New York thing, and Isaac gave he didn't know what to do with the T-shirts, so he gave them to the coat check girl. And she started selling them and didn't even know, look back. And he comes back, she gives him $2,000. I sold all those T-shirts. He goes, what? And that was the beginning of a great idea.
That and the Banana Republic shirts with the animals on them were like the coolest thing you could have in high school.
Right.
In the
80s. Well, actually the poncho with the Hard Rock Cafe logo.
It's a big deal.
Yes, I saw somebody writing about that that said that the T-shirts proclaim, I have been to the big city.
Yeah. Awesome. So So I got to ask you, too, about your Queen review. And the reason why is there's a new movie coming out.
Yeah.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Did you see it yet?
I saw it, and then I had the three guys who play Freddie Mercury, Brian May, and Deacon, the bassist, come in here. And I showed them the reviews. Your review, and then there was a later Coliseum review that you didn't write.
Right.
And they started reading them on the air, just like spoken word.
Well, it's kind of a
dramatic
brief readings of your review, isn't it?
So I wanted to get your memories, your first time seeing Queen, and you were not a fan.
Yeah, that Berklee community. I would have thought I saw them at Winterland. But I look at this. This is a 5-paragraph review. It has some material that would indicate I was there. but, you know, when I see something like this, I wonder, how high was I? It really doesn't have that kind of fine point detail that I would have, you know, been more happy with. I once ran across recently Grateful Dead review that I did at one point. And, I mean, clearly, you can only review the Grateful Dead so many times before you sort of run out of things to say, and I probably had already done that sometime. But this article did not have a single sentence in it that required me to have been at the event to develop.
Yeah.
And I just read this over, and I just wondered, you know, wow, what did I do, get up the next morning and just have a blackout? I was just like...
So did your appreciation for Queen... Are you saying that doesn't reflect your appreciation?
Oh no,
for
I remember
Queen?
Thinking they were kind of sort of a Bush League Led Zeppelin, and I think I even say that here, don't I?
Was this before the hits, like another
yeah,
one
Bush League
the
Led Zeppelin? Yeah, I think it's the second album, Queen 2.
Yeah. So when you left the Chronicle, I got to say, like, I couldn't imagine you outside of this space. I might even say I was a little bit worried, like, what will Joel do? You did just fine. You started with the Hagar book.
Yeah.
And then how many books have you written since you...
It'll be 10 years this March that I left the Chronicle.
Yeah.
And I've published 9 books.
That's not bad.
It's about as fast as I can do it. It's fun, this book writing thing. I really like it. It's challenging, and you'd be surprised how fast you get used to like 90,000 word manuscripts.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like a Sunday feature. You just start throwing big, big parts around. And the things you can do in long term that you can't do in the newspaper business, they're manifest and manifold. They just go on forever. But hey, well, I've got like 5,000 newspaper articles in my background, so I'm familiar with the nuts and bolts of the English language. But this long-term thing, that's, you know, yeah, it's an endless proposition to get this down.
I'm positioning the books because yep. I'm about to take a photo while we're doing the podcast. Fare Thee Well's the latest one. Altamont,
Fare Thee Well's
before that.
The story of the Grateful Dead after Jerry died.
Well received as well.
What a furor. What a furor. Completely panned by the San Francisco Chronicle's book reviewer.
Oh, no.
Yeah, absolutely. So much for the old boy network. But they found one of Phil's fans, and, you know, I don't think that my book found a lot of favor with the Lesh acolytes. But I've been around. They all read the Chronicle. I really felt like that the Chronicle had to be the market leader in the Grateful Dead news, or we weren't doing our job, because they had represented San Francisco worldwide, and they were right in front of us. So I was on their scene, as much as I could be. But I kept into this, and over the course of 36 years, you know, I came to know the sound people, the lighting people, the office people. And those are the folks that told me the Fare Thee Well story. Mm-hmm. They'd all been fired and long mm-hmm. gone, and they, you know, this was a painful episode of their lives. I don't think that this is a book that the deadhead writers, those guys, the chroniclers, would do, because it's just not a pretty story. It's right. got some real warts and contention and conflict in it.
Who had more drama, the Jefferson Airplane or the Grateful Dead?
Oh, no question, the airplane. The Grateful Dead had no drama, none, as long as Jerry stayed alive. They disagreed about things, but there was never any drama, never any major issues. Airplane, it was battle of the band from day one.
What are you working on now?
Well, let's see, what do we got going? I got a couple book proposals. I did another documentary movie. I wrote that Burt Burns movie.
Mm-hmm.
Attracted some interest. You know, people saw it and thought it was really good. So I ended up writing this movie about Chicago blues. It's called Born in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it's about how older generation of black musicians like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and the recently deceased Otis Rush handed off their legacy to a bunch of young white guys because they were the ones who wanted it. Mike Bloomfield, Paul Butterfield, Barry Goldberg, Steve Miller. And it's a real feel-good movie at the right time. Was Elvin Bishop, who was in the Paul Butterfield band, says, you know, we proved that, you know, we could do good things working with different races.
Hmm.
And that was not known at that time. So that's a good project.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you coming in here, man. I love your stuff. I enjoyed working with you, but it's weird. Once you left, it was this whole other relationship because I come down here and find your stuff, and I love reading your old reviews. There's always surprises, and it's always bold and honest with the reader. And I just appreciate that we've been able to stay friends and stuff. And
well, you're doing great stuff in the paper, and you're one of the spark plugs, and they need you because you actually have found some way to make the newspaper a portal that doesn't really exist on the internet. And yeah, that's what you guys have to do to make this 21st century thing happen for the newspaper. You've got to have reasons for people to need the newspaper and not online.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. So, you know, you're going to be real important in this whole thing. You are.
Cool. Thanks for coming down, Idine.
Thank you.
It's always good to see you.
Joel's my hero.
Yeah.
Well,
Idine's my favorite, you know. I think of that Phil Collins review all the time. It's like, could you do an impertinent interview with Phil Collins? And, you know, that was the beginning of his career.
we'll get deep into that one with the when we get to the Sussudio tribute on the big event.
I'll dig it up for you.
Yeah, very good. Thanks a lot for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to my guests, Joel Selvin and Idine Vaziri. Executive producer is Fernando Diaz, and our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community. Read our columns and subscribe to The Chronicle at www.sfchronicle.com. San Francisco Chronicle podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services. Listen at www.sfchronicle.com/podcasts with an S.